Senator Stedman, we have other members on the way, but I think it's important to go ahead and start. I know there's a lot of information to be presented. It's going to be on the situation report and overview of the motor vessel Sullivan-Bang IU grounding, and we have with us Admiral Jim Olson. Admiral Olson, good to see you again. Thanks so much for being here.
Good afternoon.
And Acting Commissioner Kurt Fredrickson, good to have you here as well.
Thank you, sir.
And looking forward to the information you have for us.
All right. Good afternoon, Senators. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with an update. Mr. Fredrickson and myself have put together a briefing for you. We'll try to walk through it fairly quickly and leave time for questions and answers. And we've also brought a couple of experts along with us, because we're clearly not the experts in this one. We're representing our agencies, obviously, but the experts here, Captain Ron Morris was the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, and he's with us, and the State On-Scene Coordinator was Gary Foley, and he's here with us, too. So if you have detailed or specific questions, these gentlemen certainly will be able to answer those for you. So let me jump into it with that. I think you have a brief in front of you. I'll just walk through that informally, and then and Gary and I will trade off on some parts of that. Just to go into it a little bit, and I want to walk through a little bit of the chronology of what happened, so we're all on the same page there. The 738-foot Malaysian bulk carrier Sullivan-Bang IU arrived and anchored in Seattle on November 23rd, then shifted alongside Terminal 86. The bulk carrier loaded more than 60,000 tons of soybeans before sailing from Seattle on November 28th, bound for China. On December 6th, following the Great Circle Route, the ship passed through Unimak Pass into the Bering Sea. A few hours later, the ship's main engine failed and the ship began to drift. For the next 13 hours, the ship drifted as the crew attempted to restore power. Next slide. Ship at 0400 on the 7th, the ship notified the harbor master in Dutch Harbor of a problem. Harbor master relayed this information to the Coast Guard. The Marine Safety Detachment in Dutch Harbor received the call and initiates the notifications, including the District Command Center, the Marine Safety Office in Anchorage, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the responsible party also. The Coast Guard dispatched the tug Sidney Foss, the Redeemer, and James Dunlop, and the Coast Guard cutter Alex Haley. At 1900 on the 7th of December, 126-foot, 3,000-shaft horsepower Sidney Foss tug arrived on scene after being contacted by us. The tug Sidney Foss at 8:40 by evening takes a vessel in tow, and there was pretty severe conditions at night when they were able to get the vessel in tow at that point in time. 0700 the next morning, on the 8th of December, which is the day of the grounding, the next morning, the tow line parts. The vessels on scene make several attempts to take the vessel in tow again. The ship drops its starboard anchor as it passes over a shallow area as it was drifting in, and that happened about 11:15 in the morning. The anchor held for about 1/2 hour, and apparently the chain broke again, or the chain broke for the anchor. Coast Guard helos arrived on scene. In the meantime, we had a lot of rescue operations ongoing too. At 1400, the Coast Guard helos arrived on scene, and 18 non-essential people. I say non-essential because the master wanted to keep some number of people on board. Arrived and they evacuated those 18 members, hoisted them off. No injuries from those people that were evacuated at that point in time. And by 3:25 on the 8th that afternoon, the vessel had drifted in shallow water, and a second anchor was used to have the vessel anchor at that point as it was getting near on Alaska Island. And next slide. By 17:15 or 5:15 p.m., the vessel was hard aground, and the vessel continued to drift after the anchor held up at least for some, for that period of time, it seemed to be holding, but we could tell from our tracking that it was still, that was dragging at the anchor at that point, it was getting closer to the shore.
Master called and said we wanted to evacuate the remaining crew.
We called our helicopters to respond. At that point, they did rescue hoisted seven crew members, and the helicopter went down, the Coast Guard helicopter went down about 6:23 that evening. About 19:14, the ship broke in two, and then by 20:00, the master and rescue swimmer, who was still on the water of the bow section, had been evacuated and had been rescued also.
Excuse me, I'm going to talk about, you know, for just a minute, because I'll say that Senator Ellis and Senator Wagner have been with us for some time. I appreciate them being here as well. Would you mind questions along the way?
No, sir. Go ahead.
This is probably a pretty ignorant question, but well, first, what is the destination of this vessel? And explain to me, if they're on the Grand Circle route, why they would go north of the Aleutian Islands?
Yes, sir. She was China. I'm not sure the specific port. I was going to China. And Great Circle Route is simple if you look on the globe for distance between two routes, between two points on the globe, many times is a circle path. It's not direct latitude. You know, if you look at a map, you think the shortest distance is far on the latitude. That's not the case, because we're on the globe or on the earth. The shortest distance in many cases, what we call a Great Circle Route, that is, takes from any place on the west coast of the United States, it brings you close to the Aleutian Chain, literally, going to China or Japan or even today to Singapore and down that. Those that route, if you start out from Seattle, like this vessel did, and the route takes you through the Aleutian Chain. So what most of the ships will do is go through Unimak Pass, and that's pretty close to being right on the map, and it is, obviously, because they can't go through the land or through the islands. So they pick a spot, and then they'll go back out there near Attu, between Attu and Shemi or someplace around in there.
Thanks, I appreciate that explanation. I wasn't aware of that. I'd also point out that Representative Moses is here, and if we have paragraph here, Representative Moses, if you're to come up. And sorry to interrupt you, Admiral, if you'd you want to continue with that.
Sure, no problem. Next slide, please. And that should be the drift, the chart with the drift of the Celandang. What this was is the track line at the vessel location shortly after the Coast Guard received the notification. Initially, Bogusloff Islands, island was a concern because of the large sea lion rookery located there. Celandang drifted past that. When the Sydney Frost first arrived on scene, the vessel was several miles just east of Bogusloff Island. By the morning of 8 December, as the Sydney Frost tow line had just parted, preparations were well underway to rescue the people and to be bringing a response team, moving response personnel out to in Alaska. On that morning, we requested the vessel to transfer all fuels to center tanks and to turn off their fuel heater. Purpose of that was clearly to minimize any potential of oil spilling at that point, if it were to run aground. Coast Guard Air Station Kodiak launched two helos, deployed them to Cold Bay. The Yinsen Command Center was ramping up at the Marine Safety Office in Anchorage, and personnel and equipment were being requested by the Unified Command, and they actually began moving equipment and people in towards Dutch Harbor in anticipation of the vessel going down. Next slide. Fortunately, as we were able to recover 18 crewmen before the vessel ran aground and broke in two. The master delayed the evacuation of the remaining people on board to try to regain propulsion, to try to fix the engine. When the vessel ran aground, delayed the evacuation of the rest, but weather had worsened and darkness had set in. The Coast Guard helo went down with 10 people on board, and we recovered four of those individuals from the helicopter, and eventually recovered the master and our rescue swimmer from the bow of the vessel after it had broken in two. At this point in the event, operations were primarily focused on rescuing sailors and rescuing anybody else that was we could find. Next slide. By December 9th, the next morning, any hope of finding the remaining six crewmen alive continued to dwindle as we found the wreck of a vessel washed up on shore the following morning. All of the behind-the-scenes preparation allowed us to rapidly transition our efforts into a full-fledged response to the oil spill. That afternoon, from the afternoon of 8 December into 9 December, we had established a joint information command. That was at MSO Anchorage. We Pacific Rim Logistics, a Alaska Chinook Corporation, was hired by the responsible party for spill response organizations. Unified command with the federal on-scene coordinator, the state on-scene coordinator, and the responsible party had been transferred and stood up in Dutch Harbor. Again, a lot of those people pre-positioned, including the state folks, pre-positioned the day before in anticipation of that. And a lot of the spill trajectory and impact on the beaches was already being closely looked at and monitored. Next slide. So this is just a location of on Alaska there on the map. You're all well familiar with that. And I know I can talk a little bit about the economy of the area. A lot of you are well aware that the commercial fishing industry, fish processing, fleet services, fuel repairs, and all that stuff is very vital to that part of the state and to Alaska. Next slide. The initial response, of course, we had gone through the search and rescue portion of it. We're still going through a searching part of it. The AFAC had ramped up at the same time. In fact, Kurt Fredrickson was standing next to me with the briefings that evening when we were briefing the press in Anchorage. So we were working together right from the first point. And the incident command posts in Dutch Harbor and Anchorage were stood up. I think the key to a lot of the successes that we have to this tragic event have been that we had such a strong initial response in anticipation of it, and again in a very remote area, tough to get to, having people on the ground from the state, from the responsible party, from the Coast Guard, ahead of the event actually happening. That's not been done any other time in our experience. And you could say that the circumstances were certainly a little bit different this time, and they were, but it was still very forward-leaning by everybody involved in the process. And next slide. The Coast Guard is the federal on-scene coordinator, ADEC as the state on-scene coordinator, and the responsible party representing the Selandang IU all came together as a unified command under the incident command system to get the job done. The idea of the unified command ensures that the key stakeholders are properly represented and yet working towards common goals and objectives. This is the same system that the new National Response Plan uses in response to terrorist acts and natural disasters. Needless to say, we're very pleased with how well the Unified Command has worked out, and we will be incorporating lessons learned in this incident into our plans for doing business in the future. And next slide. So we should be on 10 now. Just a few bullets there regarding the initial response. I won't spend any more time on those. This is just a picture of the unified command. I'm not sure if any of you had the opportunity to be out to visit the Grand Ocean, where we had the unified command set up. but as you can see, a lot of people in the command post, a lot of people directing and supporting the response operations, developing the plans, getting necessary permits to ensure the response is done environmentally and culturally in a proper way. And next slide. Just a list from the web page of some of the plans and permits that have been completed and in the process for the individual unified command. And last for mine, I'm going to hand it over to Kurt to take for a little bit from here. This is an artist's rendition, and there's a picture up there too that shows the vessel's condition immediately after the split when the vessel broke in two. You can see that there's seven cargo holds and three large double bottom fuel tanks as well as the aft wing tanks, from which we've recovered approximately 144,000 gallons of fuel oil and diesel oil. That said, we're pretty confident that nearly 300,000 gallons of IFO, the IFO fuel oil, has been lost. And it's pretty sure that is the case.
Sure, maybe just to move ahead, I think it's worth emphasizing that the Unified Command, when it stands up, it's real time. They're working 24/7 to get the latest information brought to bear on the incident for their planning purposes and their actions. So when we, on that page 12, when we talk about these plans, these aren't stagnant, kind of sit on the shelf plans. These are real-time plans using real-time information. The other thing to appreciate with respect to this incident, any incident in Alaska around this time of year, is you're fighting weather. The weather, of course, was a big cause of the incident itself, but safety of personnel is always number one. You just don't want to put people in harm's way. So that real-time weather data, the real-time actions that are taken are always weather-dependent and with safety in mind. One of the key plans, of course, is a safety action plan. In terms of assessing the impacts, on page 14 of the slides, we have SCAT teams, shoreline cleanup assessment teams. There's a map on the wall here that kind of shows a blow-up of how they go about their work, bringing information, going out actually on the beaches, along the shorelines, assessing the level of oiling, the terrain, the risk, what the local conditions present. Those SCAT teams then come back and advise the incident commanders, the unified command, so that they can then make their action plans specific to the information that's presented to them out in the field. Again, those are done as frequently as weather is permitted. Good, thanks. Shoreline impacts, an interesting situation here. You had oil, heavy bunker showing up on the beach offshore in the water column. But this picture on page 15 shows it pretty good. You had a fair amount of soybeans washing in. So you had two, you had the cargo and you also had the bunker oil. Wildlife impacts, of course, this is a sensitive area. I think they, I had the numbers here and they escaped me. I think the Bird Rescue Center recovered, I think, 29 birds. I think there were a little over 1,000 that at least at last count I saw, had been killed due to the oil. Hard to capture the birds, hard to recover them. The rates show that.
Fishery impacts was a big one for this. We've got a world-class fishery in the Bering Sea. One of the concerns we had about the media interest was
The impression that people had if you had a
spawn in the area that we did,
you shut down the whole Bering Sea. We who live in Alaska know that we've got big distances between the spill area and areas that might be fished. So we were concerned right off the bat. We had a fissure that was opening up within the immediate vicinity at McCushion Bay, Scan Bay. And then we had a prospective fishery, a much larger fishery, in the very sea that was going to be opening for a polar crab. The McCushion Bay was closed by fishing game. There was a fair amount of oiling in that area. We have a zero tolerance. Oil and crab, oil and fish just don't mix. We have a zero tolerance. We cannot allow our markets to be suspect at all by having any kind of tainted product. So we went to work to make sure those highly oiled areas and then we geared up with work groups of the fishermen, the processors, the local interest groups, the community, to see how we could manage the fishery so that if we had an opening, we can ensure that the product was safe to market. And if you just turn the page on screen 18, I got my glasses, shows the Bering Sea District and the fisheries in that area relative to the spill site. If you look at the Solandang, that orange arrow, that's pretty much McCushion Bay and Scan Bay that was closed. But in the Bering Sea District, right up around St. Paul, in those areas, were all going to be opened up for Opilio. And we wanted to make sure we had a good monitoring program in place. And we took some extra steps in terms of that to ensure that we had a fishery that could open safely and that we could ensure that the product was marketed without any question. Of course, we're at the same time while we're working with the processors and the fisheries and evaluating how we could open up the fishery safely, we're still dealing with the spill, and we still have the ship that's broken, which is indicated on page 19-20. I'll skip that. That's the SCAT shoreline, the SCAT surveys. Cleanup protection, what we could do when we got out there, and again, this is with IMC, the responsible party, activating local response contractors. They put boom out to protect the streams, the sensitive shoreline areas, and it was hit or miss. One day they'd be able to access the area, the next day or days they'd have to come back. They couldn't go in there. When they got back out in the field, they'd work on the booms, make sure they were still properly deployed and protecting the sensitive stream areas, which are depicted in this picture. Also, gross contamination cleanup. With the nature of this oil, you're pretty much talking Shoveling Lake shoreline cleanup, which is depicted and then bagged and ready for disposal. Just to skip, there was some larger offshore equipment brought in for offshore pickup. Current buster, booming devices, some skimmers, not particularly effective. The offshore cleanup was not really something that I don't think produced big results, and I think the current buster boom has now been taken out of service, and there's still some skimmers that are in play. Lightering was an area that was, I believe, Admiral, very successful, considering we had a ship that was on the beach broken in half. Clearly, the tanks that had been compromised had lost their fuel. But the lightering that was done on this ship recovered approximately a quarter of what the ship contained total.
About 30%. Yeah. 30%.
Again, hit or miss, bringing in a fair amount of equipment. I know, Admiral, you actually were on the deck of the stern section and observed that lightering operation. I don't know if you'd like to mention anything about that.
Yes, sir. I'd like to do that. It's pretty amazing, as you can imagine, to get out on scene and something like this. And on two occasions, actually flew out to the vessel. They had cleared the superstructure off, and I don't know if they have a good, don't have a good picture of that. Well, you do have a picture if you look at the cylinder angle. Look where the smokestack is on the stern section. Just forward of that, there's a big superstructure right there. All that superstructure, the antennas and the superstructure above the deck were removed. They were pulled off, so they had actually one of the helicopters on top of the pilot house. And that's where you'd land. They had a little landing back up there.
They'd land up there and get out of the road.
Walk through the bridge
and downstairs all the way to the main deck.
And as you can tell, when you put the water, the deck's water. But when we're out there, if it's calm enough, you can look at the decks. And that's what they're able to do, but they're with the calm periods. But to be able to crawl all around the ship that was available, literally
walk out to the end where the ship broke in half, on the ledge, look over the edge of the vessel, walk around on the deck that's many times frost covered and coral covered too, so it's very slippery.
But to see what they had to do to get the oil off, to drill, to cut through the decks, to access the tanks, to drill down and access and then pull the oil out, load it into these containers and then haul it off, it's a pretty extraordinary feat. And they work in obviously, again, very tough conditions out there. And they did an extraordinary job getting what our figures were right at 30% of the total oil that was on board. And we literally got every ounce of oil we could get off the vessel, we got off. The rest of it, unfortunately, was lost. But a lot of effort by a lot of people made that happen. And I think that's really one of the successful things we can feel good about, getting that oil off. It was a tragic wreck and all the circumstances that went into it, but we were able to get a lot of it off, so very positive there.
And these were a commercial helicopter company and hired by the...
Hired by the responsible party, that's right. Correct.
And out of Anchorage, or...?
No, it was out of Evergreen Helicopter. They're flying a Chinook, it's like a CH-47. Big, double-rotor helicopter. Yeah. Flew all the way from around California or Oregon.
Amazing operation. I can't imagine standing on the looking over the cutting edge, but
it's pretty amazing. And again, we just had it brings the light to everything that you hear about. But you smell the rotting soybeans, you smell the oil, you feel the wind from the helicopter as it's lifting off and carrying a cube of 2,000 gallons of oil off. I mean, it really is a pretty amazing operation that they did to get all that off.
Thank you. Any questions at this point? Yes, Senator Wagner.
Well, she's hard to ground right now, and when do you expect salvage operations on the two sections to take place? Not until May, June, April, May?
It can be, what we have right now is the winter wraps section, and we'll cover that in a little bit more in detail, but we've gone into the winter wraps portion of it, which means we're just monitoring things. Unless something major happens, we're probably not going to do anything until mid-April. And then we'll go into the next phase of it.
Sure. Okay, thank you. And this is the last question. Talking about hot tapping the tanks, that doesn't sound too safe, but that means you're cutting into tanks with...
Senator, that's correct. What they do is they have, it's basically an oil drilling capability, and they cut into the tanks. It's cutting through the steel, getting into the tank, and then they mount a pump right in there. Actually, they mount the device in there to do that. They found as they went in there, a lot of the tanks were baffled. It doesn't always show up in all the designs, so they got to go through several layers as they're going down into the tanks. Sometimes they had to go sideways in another tank, cut another area on top of the deck over here. So it took a lot of continued effort to get to all those tanks, because you can't just go in and the ship was flooded. So you can't just go below decks and walk in and have access to the tanks. You've got to access everything from that main deck going down through it.
Thank you. If you continue then?
Sure, on page 26, that, again, that demonstrates the weather and the decks of washes that Admiral was speaking to on occasion. But it also shows some of the terrain in that area. When you're doing shoreline work, some of those beaches are pretty rough going, and as you can see, pretty precipitous slopes on some of those areas. Cleanup continues. There's been a fair amount of gross contamination removal prior to the winter shutdown and preparing for the spring startup. These folks now are pretty much standing down, and we'll revisit in the spring that cleanup. Decon, pretty standard in a spill event. Probably not much to say on that. On page 29, the dispersants were not used in this case, but this photo is here just to show that, in fact, if you will, the tools were in the toolbox in the event that may have been needed. There were some test runs, I believe, of the equipment, but dispersants weren't actually applied in this particular case. The next page starts to demonstrate what we feel proved to be very successful, and it was our water quality monitoring program that, again, was done with a lot of cooperation by the processors and the fishermen and the various agencies. We had a number of different ways of sampling the water for oil contamination, direct soil water samples, as well as tow nets that were pulled behind some of the fishing vessels, and there were transects done around the areas to get real-time information as to where the oil might be located. And if you turn the page on the next one, this entitled Tow Net Trawls, this shows that on particular time frames, some of the surveys that were done around Dutch and the area to see if we could locate the presence of oil. And to actually avoid those areas, we were, again, facing a Bering Sea fishery that was, we felt, could proceed safely, provided we all worked together to identify where the oil was and avoid those oiled areas. So these real-time surveys allowed us to locate the oil and actually allow us to provide the fishing fleet with routes, safety routes, that where the encounter of oil would be much lower risk. And we also deployed 8 DEC seafood inspectors to Dutch to operate with the processors to inspect on a continuous basis the product, the fisheries that were coming back. And these pictures are just showing. I would also say the fishermen themselves were advised on how to monitor for the presence of oil. On the previous page, you saw, on two previous pages, on page 30, you see a little net there with a pom-pom that actually attracts oil to it. They were asked to put those in their refrigerated seawater systems. They were asked to put those in their tanks so that they could check periodically to see if there was any oil present. So with the additional scrutiny and attention given by the fishermen in watching their catch, to the surveys that were done and water quality monitoring that was done to identify, if you will, the safer areas, the safer routes to transit. And with the onshore inspection, we were able to have a successful fishery. It's an important fishery. I think it's, Acting Commissioner Reglin was here from Fish and Game. We work closely with the Department of Fish and Game. I think it's a 50 million plus fishery. We were able to have a successful fishery, and we were able to market that. All the information, these surveys, the scrutiny we gave to our shore-based inspections, all of that was provided also real-time through our web page. We have a unified command web page that in conjunction with District 17 of the Coast Guard, that we kept fresh every day. And we felt, in talking to ASME at least, we had feedback that that was very helpful for reassuring the world markets of the fishery that, in fact, the state was doing everything, as well as the fishermen were doing everything, to ensure a clean product. And we heard feedback that, in fact, that was successful, and people, the markets had a lot of confidence in what was done to take care of that. The next page, public affairs, an event like this was a large event. Not only did we have search and rescue early on and the loss of some lives, we had a ship that was actually had broken up on Alaska's beaches. The closest we came to before that was the Kuroshima right in Dutch Harbor. It didn't break apart. It remained intact, structurally intact. This was a different situation. A lot of press attention, a lot of attention, and of course a lot of local concern. So public affairs, daily meetings with the local people, the native groups, tribal and native corporations. Website was kept fresh to keep people informed, and it also helped us deal with the media inquiry. It gave the media, and we had international, we had from around the world people calling in on this event, and by alerting them to the webpage, we were able to deal with a lot of communications that would have otherwise kind of been, I think, quite a burden to our unified command. The webpage has proven itself to be a real successful tool. Salvaging on the next page, it's difficult, and that, Senator Wagner, that is something I know the Unified Command is working with the RP on as we speak, and will until spring recommences the work. And wreck assessments, and I don't know, Admiral, if you were around this, but actually had some remote operated vehicles go and look at the ship, and I think it was also in part to confirm the structural damage of the ship, and also I know people were concerned about whether or not there was a lot of oiling on the seafloor on the bottom. And the remote operation allowed us to at least get firsthand visual of that. Next page is winter operations plan. As the Admiral mentioned, we'll be spending time doing monitoring work now. There'll be surveillance overflights. We'll continue the water quality monitoring. There are still fisheries in the area. I think halibut fishing is the next fishery that will be going on in that area, and we'll be using our water quality surveys, again, those tows that will allow us to identify just the level of oiling in the area. We'll continue tracking oil movement, and we'll be training locals in HAZWOPR training, basically, or oil handling and cleanup training, so that when we get out there in the spring, we'll have a local workforce. Again, that is done through a lot of local contractors. Local map shows the location. When the operations again start this spring, they'll commence those SCAT surveys, again, to get the real time information on what's going on out on the beaches after the winter storms, and they'll be using those SCAT surveys to develop their response action plans. And I think the final one that I think we just want to emphasize in terms of the major accomplishments, and I guess speaking for the Department of Environmental Conservation, we've gone through these exercises through the Exxon Valdez. We've stood up a unified command that's been very successful here in the state. We work closely with District 17. We had people deployed before the ship broke up to Dutch Harbor. We had I think we had two employees that were out there when the ship actually was breaking up. I know Gary Foley, our state on-scene coordinator, he was leaving on the 9th to take his team out there to stand up the unified command. lighting was I think, a real accomplishment in this incident. To be able to get as much fuel off as they were able to. And you need to keep in mind that when we were working on the Kurashima, we were already stood down in winter mode while they were still working on the Selendang. So quite a success story there. Gross contamination, a fair amount of beach cleanup got taken care of this winter. So there was a lot of gross contamination taken off of the beaches. And then the final success story, we feel, is with the successful crab fishery. We tried a lot of new techniques in terms of trying to monitor the water quality and overlay what is a major fishery out there with an oil spill. That's kind of a first that we've done this year, and with real success. We did test fisheries, of course, just to take crab, to take pollock, to take halibut, and to run them through inspection before we had the openings to see if there was any gross contamination found on that product. There was not. And then we had our real-time monitoring of water quality, our tow samples, and our other onboard monitoring that was done by the actual fishermen. And the fact that we were able to have a successful fishery, in our mind, was quite an accomplishment. And then the last, again, we're still operating this incident, and will through the spring. And we will have our web page up and running, the Unified Command web page up and running to communicate with interested people from really around the world.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. I'm really pleased to hear that the Unified Command works so well. I guess we probably all realize that it could have been much worse. I mean, it could have been a larger spill, it could have been more dangerous one, it could have been more impact on fisheries. So, but you feel that the command structure you have together can the situation?
I think the command structure is excellent. And I think I'm not sure, and the Admiral may be able to speak to this, but I'm particularly proud of District 17 and the State of Alaska Unified Command. I think we're cutting edge. I don't know if they have anything that's as well organized and practiced as you find here in Alaska. It can always be worse, and to be honest with you, when the Admiral and I were standing together, I think it was on the 9th, and you had been out there, the Admiral flew, got back into Anchorage at 10 o'clock that evening, and the press was dying to hear. And you're thinking, here it is, December 9th, out there in the Aleutians, there's no roads out there. We didn't have many of the advantages that we did with the Kurashima right there in Dutch Harbor. I had my doubts that there was going to be much we could do with this particular incident. I was at that time thinking it's very likely this ship's going to break apart, and we'll probably lose the entire, all the fuel from the tanks. So to sit here in February and think about what has been accomplished under the Unified Command. I might also mention, with respect to the Unified Command and the Admiral and I, we call it crisis management here in Alaska. There's incident command is real important and needs to be stood up and maintained and supported so that they can do the job out there in the field. Well, there's a tremendous amount of work that involves governors and the legislature and corporate headquarters and the command structure within the Coast Guard that needs to be addressed as well. Inquiries need to be dealt with, questions need to be answered, decisions need to be made, and that's at a crisis management level. That's where the Admiral and we come together to deal with some of those issues that you just wouldn't want to find the Unified Command there in Dutch Harbor with. And that's really what we were doing on the 9th, I believe, was addressing a lot of those pressing inquiries that were important, needed to be addressed, and yet the Unified Command had to be dealing with those field command decisions.
If I could add, Senator, I agree with with Mr. Fredrickson completely. It seems like one of the lessons learned that we with the use of the website, as far as information flow, and we use the website to stand up the press releases and all that stuff from the beginning. And that site had 9 hits in the first week. The interest in, like you said, all around the world, like those hits came from. So that interest level and the flow of information by doing that provides a consistent, accurate flow of information. Everybody gets the same story. It's not passed by word of mouth. It's not a phone call. There are all different words in the news before. It's not a series of messages where things are a little bit different all along. People get to look at the chronology. They get to see what's happening. And as it's posted on there, it's a chronology. This is what we did now. This is what we did. This is what we made. This is what's happened. That all those current updates really work very well. And that helps, you know, internally with the organizations within the Coast Guard, within the Department of Homeland Security, within the state, and to the responsible party, as well as going outside as dealing with the press and the public who have a right to know too. So all of those things from the information flow side, I think we've learned a lot of lessons on how to do it better. And kudos to the folks on the scene. You know, I'll emphasize that. That's a tough job. Tough operating environment, tough remote location, tough to get the equipment out there, all the delays they had, everything, the decisions they made as far as how to get that off, and it goes credit to these folks in the Unified Command sitting behind us, and Ron Morris and Gary Foley are two of those individuals. The responsible party stepped up too. They stepped up and continued to finance and pay their share, and were very, very aggressive in how they responded to this. So, hats off to all of them.
Is there anyone who want to speak before we do any questions from members of the committee? Thank you. We have, for answers only, apparently, Mr. Ron Filimonov, is that right? At St. Paul, are you there, Ron?
Yeah, I'm here listening.
Okay, you have nothing to say, you're just listening?
Yeah, I just heard about the meeting, so I'm just standing by trying to catch up on what you guys are up to there.
Thanks, Ron, appreciate that. Could you identify TDX Corporation?
Yeah, I'm the Village Corporation from St. Paul, and we have major land holdings in and around the Sound Egg spill down there. I'm very concerned about the damage it's doing to our land and property.
Okay, thank you, Ron, and if you have any questions that pop up, let us know and we'll give you some time. Thanks for being with us. Danny Havlund and Russ Thorpe are also with us. Mr. Havlund and Mr. Thorpe? Are you there?
Good afternoon, all. How are you today?
Very good. Thank you very much. And
who are you? We're a joint venture, Construction Resources, Chillout Parts Equipment Supply. We're a supplier to Gallagher and several other outfits out there. Well, a few questions about money. Is that a good time to talk about it?
But I'm sorry, I can't hear you very well. Let's hear him. Tell me again who you represent and your name, please, slowly.
Everybody
else. Just dropped off. Okay, well, we'll as soon as we get him back, we'll allow him to speak. Let's go on with Rick Steiner in Anchorage. Mr. Steiner, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes, please go ahead, Rick, and identify yourself and who you represent.
Those are both very good questions. Rick Steiner, I'm a professor and conservation specialist at the University of Alaska Marine Advisory Program, but my comments today are simply on behalf of the Shipping Safety Partnership, which I'll mention in just a second. First of all, I'd like to commend the committee for holding this hearing. This is directly in the Alaska legislative interest, certainly state interest. There's enormous amount of cultural resources, subsistence resources, and natural resources that have been impacted by this. So, congratulations to the committee for hosting perhaps many such hearings. The other thing I'd like to say is, and with all respect to the Admiral and the Commissioner, there are certainly some success stories in the response to this disaster. However, when you stand back from this and really look at the entire scope of what happened here, I'd say the glass is about 95% empty and maybe 5% full. It's a failure that we even having to sit here today and talk about this disaster, because the risk in this transit and this maritime transportation route has been well known for decades. It has been pointed out to the state of Alaska and the U.S. Coast Guard for decades. If we learned anything from the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989, we simply learned that, you know, any response basically is almost ineffective. The reality of this one is it's the largest spill in Alaska since the Exxon Valdez. We lost 6 human lives, thousands, if not tens of thousands, of birds and marine mammals. We lost the vessel and its cargo, and the political damage alone. And whatever you have in the same sentence in the United States, in the national media, Alaska, oil, and environmental damage, you can do the calculation of what the political implications of that are. The cost of this so far has been at least $25 million in response, $30 million for a Coast Guard helo that went down. I don't know what the vessel and cargo is worth, but $20 or $30 million there. We've lost economically at least $70 or $80 million to date. When you start adding in the natural resource damage liability and the personal liability for the lost lives, et cetera, this is going to be between $100 and $200 million just in financial loss from this one disaster that was a disaster waiting to happen. And anybody that looked at the system probably recognized this. The injury from this is unacceptable and unnecessary. The wreck, however, that we need to focus on, and in our opinion, is the next one, not this one. This one's in the history books, unfortunately. Once the oil's in the water and the boat's on the beach, broken in half, state for what they have been able to do with a very ugly situation. They've done about as good as could be expected with the resources that they had in place there in Dutch Harbor. What I'd like to mention very quickly is the Shipping Safety Partnership that has coalesced and formed amongst a number of non-governmental organizations focusing specifically on preventing these sorts of disasters in the future. The goal of the partnership is essentially to increase the safety, improve the safety of this maritime transit route to the Aleutian Islands and the Southern Bering Sea. Founding members include the Northwest Urban Indian Community in Washington State. That's about 7,000 that live in the Washington State area. The Alaska Native Fishermen Association, other groups in state and out of state, the Alaska Center for the Environment, the Alaska Oceans Program, who is the administrative home for the partnership, Pacific Environment, Alaska Marine Conservation Council, World Wildlife Fund, and on and on and on. So there's several thousand individuals and several groups that are members of this partnership. We commend the governor for suggesting that a risk assessment be done. This is something, of course, that was asked for in 1998. That's wonderful. We applaud that. That absolutely needs to be done. And the time that that is to be done, which would take at least a year, perhaps two, to do a truly comprehensive quantitative risk assessment. And I don't know how much money will be necessary to do that. But in the time that it takes to do that, and by the way, I would suggest in that risk assessment, we also look at Cook Inlet, Southeast Alaska, and potentially the northern sea route that will certainly open up someday with the loss of ice cover in the Bering Sea. We also need a rescue tug and a tracking system, a vessel tracking system. The vessel tracking system is easily doable with existing technology on the vessel. The Coast Guard can track any of these vessels going through the route. There's several thousand, 4,000, 5,000, maybe 6,000 vessels going through our waters every year. A lot of cargo on board, a lot of fuel, a lot of hazardous cargo. the rescue tug, we know that, an adequate open ocean rescue tug likely could have averted this disaster from occurring in the first place. We can go into detail on that at some point in the future if you'd like to talk about it. What I'd like to close with is asking for the Alaska legislature to look at an interim protection program in the Aleutians and the time it takes to conduct a risk assessment. We know that a risk assessment will say we need a tracking system and a rescue, an adequate open ocean rescue tug on station in Dutch Harbor or Unimak on the one side, and then over in Attu and Shimia, as the Admiral mentioned, the other entrance and exit to the Bering Sea on the western side. And what I suggest is that the state, that the legislature appropriate, look at emergency appropriations of $5 million to DEC out of the 470 fund, the response fund that the state has, the Oil and Hazardous Substance Relief Prevention and Response Fund that was set up post Exxon Valdez. Look at a $5 million emergency appropriation out of that to commission, to charter an adequate open ocean rescue tug to be on station this month out at Unimak Pass. I have been in touch with Smit and the Netherlands. They're running some numbers for us, and then we'll get those to us here in the next, hopefully, day or two, and we will forward those to the legislature and to DEC and the Coast Guard. But in the time it takes to do the risk assessment, many of us, certainly the Shipping Safety Partnership members, feel that we need to have some interim protection in this system. There could be a disaster tonight out there, as any of us know. So I think that's all I'll have to say at this moment, except for the fact that this is a state responsibility as well as a Coast Guard responsibility. The fact that one of these vessels breaks down in federal waters is almost irrelevant if it's drifting into state waters with state-managed resources. And so the state of Alaska has a, I think, a sacrosanct and a mandatory responsibility to provide a rescue tug to prevent this sort of grounding to the extent that we can. So I'll close with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. I appreciate you sending us a copy of your letter to Governor Murkowski dated January 20th. And I appreciate your testimony and the fact that you have not only made it clear your concerns, but also made a very specific recommendation as well. Would you comment on item number 7, page 3, consideration of routing further from shore? Would you explain that? The vessels still need to go through the Aleutian chain. How would that work?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Well, certainly, unfortunately, because these are vessels of innocent passage, and I believe Admiral Olson can explain to you some of the nuance of all of that, there is only so much that the state government and federal U.S. government can ask of them. Now, we can, however, through voluntary agreements with the International Maritime Organization, establish what's called areas to be avoided, ATBAs, or particularly sensitive sea areas, PSSAs. The first mandatory PSSA or ATBA, I believe, was just established, and I can't remember exactly where that was. But these vessels, to the extent that they can stay further from sensitive habitats, fishery areas, seabird nesting areas, sea lion, harbor seals, et cetera, and fishing grounds, the further away they are, clearly, the easier it's going to be to render a save to a disabled vessel, or if they break up and have a spill or a loss of hazardous cargo, the more time that will have to evaporate and disperse and dissolve in seawater. The further away these vessels can be from sensitive habitats, the better. And I found it very, very encouraging in Commissioner Fredrickson's response to my letter on behalf of the governor that they basically essentially say that the governor has asked the U.S. Coast Guard to assess the risk which international Pacific in order to direct traffic away from our productive fishing grounds. I found that to be a significant statement. We can't always keep them away from productive areas, but we can certainly request that they do. There are certainly certain voluntary agreements that we could ask for that they just stay, 50 miles out, 100 miles out. But
to the extent that they're very close to state waters, such as going through Unimac Pass, they need to, one, all agree to subscribe to a vessel tracking system, and secondly, that perhaps they need to cough up some money for a standby rescue tug there 24/7 at Unimac to render say that they have a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Senator Wagoner has a question.
I just I wanted to check with you, Senator, Mr. Steiner. You had some facts and figures you threw out, such as loss of marine life and tens of thousands of numbers. Where did that information come from?
Yes, sir. Thank you. The total recovered bird carcasses to date are 1,600, plus the few lost in the rehab. The Exxon Valdez ratio of the number of recovered carcasses to the number that washed away uncounted was about 10 to 1. So in other words, for every dead bird carcass that is recovered, there's a ratio of lost but not recovered. The Fish and Wildlife Service has done some drift block experiments out there, dropping some orange drift blocks to see how many are recovered, and using some, we're doing some modeling right now to try to get to extrapolate from the number of dead birds that have been recovered what the range of total mortality has been. If you use a 10 to 1 ratio from 1,600 birds recovered, you've got 16,000 right there. It could be higher than that in the Aleutians, and I suspect it may be. It may be lower. But regardless of that, that's just the acute mortality to date. The other significant component of injury to the bird, we're just talking birds right now, is the sublethal chronic injury, which we have found in Exxon Valdez, you know, through the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of science that has been done on them, can be actually as devastating as the initial mortality. So there's going to be chronic mortality to the bird populations there probably for years to come. So the total number, the total carcass recovery number comes from the Unified Command website and from Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Appreciate your testimony and look forward to hearing from you in the future on this issue. Let's go on to try Danny Havlin and Russ Thorpe again. Are you with us, Mr. Havlin?
Hello, can you hear us now?
I can, and if you'd speak a little slowly and identify your name and who you represent.
Russ Thorpe, Construction Resources.
Danny Havlin, Chill Out Parts and Equipment Supply.
Thank you very much. And if you'd go ahead with your testimony.
We have more of a concern than a testimony. We've been a supplier in equipment, supplies, personal protection equipment since it started, since before they had an active purchase order system in there. And from day one, we've had stonewalling and trouble getting payment, schedules of payment, purchase order numbers, things like that returned to us. We're guaranteed we have in the future, if we supply to them, that we get paid. Are they bonded in the U.S.? Do we have any recourse if they're an offshore company?
Okay, I'm not sure I understood, but you are saying you are a supplier and you're not receiving payment for the supplies you provided. Mr. Fredrickson, do you have any information on this?
I don't really. I don't know if, it would be my understanding that the payer of those supplies would be the responsible party. Yeah. And as a recourse, then they can go to the federal or state funds, I would imagine.
Yeah. Sir, I have been submitting bills to Nancy Goodall, who is in charge of the finance corps at Gallagher Marine Systems, and at first she would not respond at all. So we went to the Coast Guard in Dutch Harbor and asked them for a schedule of payments. Her response was to blacklist us as a supplier, and then everything that I had sent in, she said she did not have proof that it was delivered. Jackie Wallace, the incident commander out there, gave her all the information and things that were not already logged into a warehouse because they immediately went on a boat. He found, made sure that she knew all of this stuff, and because it wasn't in her format, as in receipt to the warehouse and then dispersed, she will not pay it. She has paid part of the funds, items that were shipped along right in the same ship with other items. She has said they did not receive them, has no record of them ever being ordered, and yet they have used them on the job. We have found out if they are not a bonded company. We want to know how come we have to be bonded and we can't get paid. They have no, there is no recourse, because when we called the company back in New Jersey, their response was to evidently get a hold of her, blacklist us, and not return our call from New Jersey.
I think if I can, Senator, we'll have Unified Command look into that. We can certainly look into the details and find out the answers for you.
Well, I appreciate that, but I do want to let you know that it's not just me, you know, crying because I didn't get paid. This is something that other vendors have spoken with me about. They've had the same problem, no response from this company, and when they do get paid, it is a slow pay. We do want to make sure that we can, as Alaskan companies, I've been in business for 11 years and selling to DEC and everybody else, but when I get responses that said, no, you did not really deliver these things, you're lying to me, it really irritates me. And then get responded as, we're not going to deal with you. The orders have been from other companies. They say the same thing. We found out that we better get paid before they ship. They won't prepay any items, but they have evidently made agreements to purchase more PPE and spill response items from a local New Jersey company rather than take the bids that they received from at least four other suppliers here in Alaska.
Okay. Yes, go ahead, Senator Stebbin. Yes,
we appreciate your concerns. Maybe we could give the Admiral the courtesy of some time, and he can go back and with Unified Command and respond back to us, because clearly they need the opportunity to respond to these issues, and quite frankly, I don't think it's right for this particular table at this time.
I wondered about that, but we do need some kind of response. We need to know if the purchase order book matches the checkbook, so to speak.
I appreciate your concerns, and certainly, as an Alaskan supplier, you need to be paid for what you've done. This is really not the right forum for that, but we will ask. The Admiral has said that the Unified Command will take this up and see if they can figure out what the problems are.
How would they contact us, or how would we contact them to follow up?
And let's see.
Phone number.
Can you tell us how we can contact you?
688-3998.
688-3998.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm sorry that we can't solve this right here, but hopefully we can get an answer for you shortly through the Unified Command.
We didn't mean to put a damper on your success story, but we
wanted... No, not at all. We want to make sure that Alaskans and everyone are paid for the services they provide.
Yeah, they're 54 days out on $32,000. It's a fair chunk of change. They were 100,000 out, so tough going for little guys.
Certainly, I understand that. Senator Wagoner?
Well, I just wanted to tell you, folks, you are part of the success story if you're supplying with equipment and supplies necessary to clean up.
Well, we put on extra crew at Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, New Year's. 3-4 in the morning. We thought we put in the effort. We didn't mark up our prices beyond retail. We didn't gouge anybody. We delivered to the airplanes. We thought we did right for it.
Well, thank you. And I'd appreciate it if once you hear it, once this progresses and you get an answer, that's great. If you don't, please contact my office, 1-800-821-4925.
We'll do that. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks very much. Let's move on then to, we have another person in Anchorage to testify, Tom Lokosch. Mr. Lokosch, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Lokosch. I am the lead investigator for Parker Associates that's been contracted by the Alaska Oceans Program to conduct an investigation of the incident to provide recommendations that would protect Alaskans' interests in the future from such incidents. I might preface this comment with the disclaimer that that the investigation is in the preliminary stages here, and these are some initial observations that have been made given the information we've been supplied to date. There are approximately 10 tank vessels. Oh, by the way, this has been faxed down to your office in writing. It's approximately 2 pages long, page and a half. There are approximately 10 tank vessels and 200 non-tank vessel oil spill contingency plans for federal and private vessel serving ports on the Aleutian chain. The public and private resources sent to prevent and respond to the Selendang IU incident are essentially the same resources that will respond in the existing contingency plans. The response to this incident was an unmitigated failure, adversely impacting planned fisheries openings and oil many miles of the National Marine Preserve. Alaskans can therefore expect similar damage to their resources and interruption of their fisheries when any of the existing contingency plans are implemented under similarly demanding conditions. Despite the fact that three tugs and a coast guard were on scene prior to the grounding, none of these vessels prevented the grounding of the Selendang IU. This is particularly disturbing when any of these assist vessels could have attached tow lines with the assistance of the Coast Guard helicopters and prevented the anchor from dragging and thus preventing the grounding. The Chagall Corporation was told many of the spill response contracts for the Aleutian chain did not boom the leaking vessel, nor did it employ spill response equipment readily available and designed for response to spills of viscous oil in high seas. Glidering efforts, although ultimately partially effective, did not meet the standards of Alaskan law requiring the best available technology and were not immediately available as required by law. The amount of oil released by the Selendang IU is roughly equivalent to the amounts planned for in multiple tank vessel contingency plans, and the fuel oil is more damaging to the environment because of the persistence of the oil than the product carried by many of the tank vessels that require seaplanes. Yet none of the thousands of innocent passage vessels that transit the chain every year carry such seaplanes. The Alaska legislature must take steps to ensure that Alaska's interests are protected from all of these threats to our valuable resources, our livelihoods, and our legacy. The legislature must insist that DEC enforce its jurisdiction throughout the EEZ, Exclusive Economic Zone, as has been previously legislated, and must ensure that the plans that are in place can actually effectively respond in the demanding conditions along the chain. The legislature must also consider closing the perceived gap in state jurisdiction in UMAC Pass that has a shorter distance, shore to shore, than many other areas along our coast that are considered state waters. Two of the 10 tank vessel seaplanes for ADAC and Dutch Harbor require the use of escort tugs in state waters. Despite the responsible and well-intentioned efforts of the Aleut Enterprise Corporation and Delta Western to require escort tugs in state waters, the available tugs are wholly underpowered and are likely incapable of succeeding in rescue attempts in severe conditions as exampled by this incident. Parker Associates, on contract to the Alaska Oceans Program, is presently investigating concept designs that could effectively rescue vessels in distress, contain the spill, stop the oil leaks, and prepare the stricken vessel for immediate lightering. We sincerely hope that the legislature and DEC and or the U.S. Coast Guard would appropriately assign the cost of these two rescue tugs stationed at UNIMAC Pass and Shemya to be borne by the thousands of ships that would be served by these prevention and response assets. We would hope that the agencies would require close escort of all tank vessels through the Aleutian passes and otherwise through state waters when they sail to Alaskan ports. We would hope that the Coast Guard and the Department of Defense would take lead responsibility for these tugs because they are responsible for their own tank vessel visits and non-tank vessel transits to ports from Kodiak to Attu. These tugs could also be easily designed to perform buoy tendering duties along the Aleutian Chain, which is presently within the purview of the U.S. Coast Guard. Even if the tugs would be privately owned and operated, there is a clear need to reevaluate Coast Guard practices and equipment to better perform vessel rescue operations and spill response as part of their standard departmental and safety of law at sea duty, their vessel contingency plans, and in the role as responders in sub-area contingency plans. If these options do not bear fruit in the near term, we suggest that funds be made available for vessel construction through the dedicated federal and or state oil spill trust funds set up by Open 90 and HB 470. We at Parker Associates and the Alaska Oceans Program understand that the weather conditions along the chain are extremely demanding, but the available resources are far below the standard of what is presently within the state of the art, and we will endeavor to provide competent advice on practical solutions and promising areas of research. It is clearly practical to deploy interim rescue and response improvements by providing for a standby salvage tug as part of the required contract to remove the Selendang IU from its present grounding position. We suggest this cost be borne by the present set of over 200 contingency plan holders and or the trust funds mentioned above. If the thousands of vessels presently transiting the Great Circle Route weren't enough of a threat, the legislature must remember that the export ban has been lifted and that Russia is planning to ship oil and gas east from the field in Sakhalin and from a pipeline plan to the Vladivostok region. Alaska can no longer turn a blind eye to the repeated fouling of our precious resources and must take immediate legislative and administrative action to design our contingency plans to encompass all threats of catastrophic oil spill damage and to provide competent capability for preventing and responding to spills in our challenging environment. If there are any questions, Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to answer any inquiries.
Thank you, Mr. Lockish. Could you provide me
It should have been faxed down already. I'm not sure.
We haven't received it yet, but it might very well be. So you might try again. The fax is 465-3517. You might call my office to see if they. We'll find out. How do we get in touch with you?
My phone number in Anchorage is 907-563-7380. It's on the top of this written statement I prepared, and my email address is lakosh@gci.net.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lockish. I look forward to getting that a copy of your testimony. And going on to from the same firm, Mr. Parker, Walter Parker, are you there?
Mr. Chairman, I have very little to add to what Tom has just told you. He's been working 16 years on this best available technology, and as you're aware, won at the Supreme Court on the issue. We didn't know about this hearing until this morning, so what he just gave you is something we had to put out in a big hurry. The situation in shipping in the North Pacific is changing so dramatically that it's going to require a lot of work. And, when I chaired the Alaska Oil Spill Commission, we were given substantial resources by the legislature and the governor to move forward very rapidly on that. Now it's a much more complex situation because of the intervention of the shipping from the Far East, where you have a country, the Republic of China, that is very new in international maritime trade and doesn't have the built-in things that we rely on in North America, Europe, and Japan to make sure that that trade is conducted at the highest possible standards. So we need to find out a lot more about those thousands of ships that have been mentioned that are going to be passing by our shores. And this is a long effort for me. I've been at this since the Torrey Canyon, and through the Alaska pipeline and setting up these conditions under which we open Valdez now to and the Exxon Valdez now to this. So it promises to be a hard effort. As I approach my 80th year, I don't have the energy I had 16 years ago to do it, so we'll rely on Mr. Lockish and Rick Steiner and the younger people to carry this ball.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. I'm glad that you had a chance to testify, that you did hear about this meeting. I appreciate your comments. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify at this time?
Mr. Chairman, this is Tom Lockish again. I just checked with the attendant here, and apparently my comments were faxed to your office, and you might be able to get it with a runner.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lockish. I'm sure it's there then now. Look forward to getting to reading that. Anybody else who wishes to testify? Really appreciate Emma Olson, Mr. Fredrickson, you're taking the time and your comments, and certainly want to put you on the spot, but I appreciate at a later date maybe Mr. Fredrickson talking to you about the suggestions that we've heard, the vessel tracking, the rescue tugs, the interim protection, all of those things, just so I understand the situation. I appreciate talking to you about that. Anything further anyone has to say? Really appreciate everyone's participation, and this meeting is adjourned.